Welcome to the September 11th edition of Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week, Groundwire is produced at CKDU Campus Community Radio at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. We're your hosts. I'm David Parker.
And I'm Melissa Albiani.
We are doing this because we think that we deserve our basic rights as workers.
In terms of the conditions in the prisons, they were absolutely horrible. Racist to the core.
Our occupation of reoccupation and repopulation of our territories, this is one of the first steps.
The Schaefer family has made it very clear that they are hoping that the Court of Appeal will allow this application to be heard and go forward.
In this edition, Groundwire remembers the Attica prison insurrection 40 years later. Resistance to oil pipelines heats up on the West Coast. The Justice for Levi campaign in Ontario takes it to the courts. And African Nova Scotians make history in Canada as the first group to join the 6th Region Diaspora Caucus of the African Union.
But first, Frieda Worden and Gretchen King bring us this episode's headlines.
On July 10th, the Simon Fraser University Student Society locked out the workers of QP3338 Unit 5. That unit includes all the employees who perform the work of the society, such as office management, event management, and interacting with students. But it also includes the coordinators of the Women's Center and out on campus. According to Student Society President Jeff McCann, the society has run a structural deficit for several years and no longer has enough money to pay wages ranging from around $18 to $30 an hour. And they were frustrated after trying to negotiate for 2 years. With the lockout, the society also announced a unilateral 40% wage cut. The locked-out workers set up a picket line. The Student Society used social media to say money saved from locking out the workers could go to student clubs. After more than 10 weeks of stalemate, as the fall semester began, the Student Society made a new offer. Job security and no wage cuts for current employees, but lower wages for new employees coming in. The CUPE bargaining unit voted to turn that down and called for a negotiated settlement, not just a take-it-or-leave-it offer. The Student Society website now has a link saying, "Click here to tweet in support of the lockout," above a line saying, "The offer was rejected. What else can we do?"
Since the first day of classes, students at McGill University have been crossing vibrant picket lines organized by MNECA, the campus's largest union of non-academic staff representing more than 1,700 workers, including library staff, lab technicians, and registration staff. Groundwire joined MNECA's president, Kevin Whitaker, on the picket line.
What drove MNECA to strike? Because as far as I understand, in your whole union's history, this is the first time you've gone on strike here.
That's correct. We were in negotiations with the university since January, and only recently we've come to the point where they are not addressing any of our key points. They're remaining firm on their positions, and we have nowhere to go with that.
Students got an email from the administration, from Mike DeGrappa, explaining how this university has been voted as the work environment is in the top 100.
I'm not quite sure how it got rated in the top 100. I'm interested to know who they spoke to, because I can tell you they didn't speak to the labor groups.
McGill students like Nina Amrov, who work on campus and are part of MNECA, are talking to other students crossing the picket line to get to class.
What I'm saying is basically we're not doing this to piss you off. We are doing this because we think that we deserve our basic rights as workers, and support us, basically, because this is not only for you new students, but for future students as well. Also for future workers, students that maybe also will end up working here at McGill as well.
A week into the strike, both parties have returned to the bargaining table. After negotiations failed to move forward, MNECA released a statement on their website, www.munaca.com, stating that McGill will have to seriously address their core concerns, including pensions, benefits, and wages, before any progress will be made.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
The power of 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 the power of
That was Aquala by JFM from the album Compost.
Now it's time for our feature stories.
As of September 6th, over 1,200 protesters against the proposed Keystone XL pipeline have been arrested in the U.S. The pipeline plans to send oil from Canada's tar sands to U.S. markets. Resistance is heating up on traditional territories north of the border as well. Journalist Don Paley documented the activities of an Indigenous group from the Wet'suwet'en First Nation as they set up blockades on their land. The following is a report originally filed for Free Speech Radio News.
Wet'suwet'en territory covers over 13,000 square miles in the western Canadian province of British Columbia. Their lands were never surrendered or ceded to the Canadian government.
My name is Togastai. I hold a hereditary chief name from the Fireweed clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. You're just driving into Wet'suwet'en or the Unist'ot'en territory.
The Wet'suwet'en people participated in Delgamuukw, one of the most significant rights and title cases ever heard in Canada.
Well, the Delgamuukw decision was a victory for the Wet'suwet'en. It was a Supreme Court decision, Supreme Court of Canada. And the premise of the whole decision was the Wet'suwet'en do have title, but we have to negotiate with existing government and existing industry on how we plan on managing the territories from that day on. It was December of 1997.
But after the ruling, the Wet'suwet'en were unable to recuperate control over their territories.
Things just didn't happen the way they were supposed to. But there was no assertion strategy. There was no efforts to come out and just say, you know, these territories belong to us and we're going to manage it like this. There's none of that. People got drawn into this whole British Columbia Treaty Commission agenda, and we got distracted from looking after our territories.
Togastai and others are building a cabin in the path of proposed oil and gas pipelines on land belonging to the Unist'ot'en clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. Frida Warner from the Unist'ot'en described what is at stake.
Our clan wants a future for our children, grandchildren, and we know that's not going to happen if we continue just to sit back.
Activists decided to put the sturdy log cabin in the direct right-of-way of three different proposed pipelines. A twin pipeline proposed by Calgary-based Enbridge would carry tar sands oil to the BC coast. A 32-inch in diameter gas pipeline is also proposed to carry gas obtained from hydraulic fracturing from northeast BC to the coast. The gas line is proposed by a consortium including Houston, Texas-based Apache and EOG Resources and Calgary's Encana. A stone's throw from the cabin is the Maurice River. Mel Basil, an activist from the Wet'suwet'en and Gitxsan Nation, explains the significance of the site.
Right now we're standing directly on the GPS point of the proposed Enbridge Inc. Northern Gateway Pipeline proposal. And this is also our place where we're going to be standing off with them the most because this river is precious.
For Basil and others, the struggle against natural gas and tar sands pipelines is part of a culture of renewal.
Our occupation of reoccupation and repopulation of our territories, this is one of the first steps. We plan to have hundreds of these cabins built on our territories once again because our people did not only live in one village. Our people often abandoned the villages and lived in their cabins throughout the winters and trapped and hunted throughout the winter. And so we're getting that seasonal round back into our system by repopulating the territories as a culture of resistance.
Community members also put up barbed wire fencing. Elder Hank Rosso took out his chainsaw, ready to get to work to support the resistance.
Well, I think it's a good idea putting up the fence, because if we didn't put up the fence in the sign, there was that other gas line we're going to trespass. They come in last week and asked me, and I told them they weren't allowed here.
As work finished for the day, a large banner was hung outside the camp. It read, "No pipelines." The cabin and the banner mark another concrete step in what promises to be a long struggle to prevent the construction of new oil and gas pipelines. Don Paley, Unist'ot'en Territory, British Columbia, FSRN.
Last week, the Ontario Court of Appeal held hearings on the events leading to the death of Levi Schaefer, on whether or not the actions of the police were legally authorized. Schaefer was a youth killed in 2009 by an OPP officer in the remote northern Ontario wilderness. The family of Levi continues their quest for justice, despite OPP attempts to quash the case. Aaron Lakoff from CKUT filed this report for Groundwire.
In late summer 2009, Levi Schaefer, a man from Peterborough, Ontario, traveled approximately 2,000 kilometers by bike and foot to the depths of a northern Ontario forest. He was diagnosed in his early 20s with schizophrenia and struggled through a difficult life, deeply impacted by poverty, criminalization, and mental health stigmatization. On June 24, 2009, Levi was killed on a lakeshore near the town of Pickle Lake when an Ontario provincial police officer shot him in the chest. At the time, the officers had been investigating a missing boat. Ruth Schaefer, the mother of Levi Schaefer, spoke with Groundwire on the phone from Peterborough. She told us about the moment when she found out about her son's death.
And then I came home one day and the SIU were at my door. And I knew right away that he'd been killed. So when they started to tell me how it had happened, my immediate response was I thought that he'd had a psychotic break and that there were probably two victims, the poor man who had to shoot him and my son. But after they started to talk, I realized that that couldn't possibly be true from what they were telling me. And nothing fit together in a logical way or in a way that made sense from my really deep knowledge of my son.
After Levi was killed, the OPP found his ID in his tent. Despite this, Levi's body was sent back to his family many days later, marked as John Doe. One of the main controversial points surrounding the case of Levi Schaefer is over the Ontario Provincial Police, or OPP's, incident report notes. An investigation into the incident revealed that officers involved were instructed to hold off writing their notes or making statements for days after the shooting occurred, after they'd spoken with their lawyers. The Schaefer family has taken the OPP to court to end this practice of lawyer note vetting because they say it has an impact on the evidence in the case. Here's Ruth Schaefer again.
What really hit me was the fact that I can only conjecture what happened to my son. I'll never know what happened to him. And that nobody should have to experience that sort of emotional stress. And so I decided to go to court to try and make it so that the police had to follow the law and so that there was some sort of evidentiary tracking system that the police would be required to follow.
From September 7th to 9th, the Schaefer family, along with the Justice for Levi Coalition, a group dedicated to supporting the family, was at the Ontario Court of Appeal to determine if the actions leading to Levi's death were legally authorized or not. The police are trying to quash the motion and send it to the Ontario Legislature rather than the courts. Rochelle Sauvé of the Justice for Levi Coalition in Peterborough explains why the family has not yet filed a lawsuit against the OPP.
Now, the Schaefer family has made it very clear to the Court of Appeal that although an application has been put forward towards a suit against the police officers, as the courts had indicated, might be a good idea, that the family, in fact, has no intention directly of pursuing a suit and has not, in fact, delivered the paperwork for a suit to any officers because they are hoping that the Court of Appeal will allow this application to be heard and go forward and that the justice being sought, which is far more broad-based than, you know, where your kid got killed, here's a bit of money, but that the application could finally be heard and that that suit would never be presented to the officers involved.
However, the OPP recently launched a counter-lawsuit of $92,000 against Ruth Schaefer for the cost the police force has incurred as a result of the trial.
It basically becomes class warfare where if the police... I'm very lucky to have such a competent lawyer who is not allowing them to drag things out for years and years. But in a lot of cases, that's what happens, and so people give up because the money runs out, and people run out of energy to keep raising money. And so when somebody comes back to you, and you know you're doing the right thing, but somebody comes back to you and says you have to pay $92,000, it's horrifically frightening to somebody like me. I'm 52. I have nothing left after this. And so it becomes class warfare.
The Justice for Levi Coalition are currently raising money for their legal battle. Supporters are encouraged to donate money at www.justiceforlevi.org. For Groundwire, this is Aaron Lakoff from CKUT Radio in Montreal.
Groundwire will be right back after this music break.
The cops are out killing kids again. Oh, once love will never be the same. A bathroom filled with hate, the blood is drained and she's to blame. Your parents died a long time ago, they're just empty shells. And now that you let go, they're letting go, they're letting go. Your politics is a fight almost in.
That was G20 Mummy by Halifax-based Snail Party from their album BFCSD.
This summer, town hall meetings were organized across Nova Scotia, bringing together hundreds of African Nova Scotians. Activists from the community and from the 6th Region Diaspora Caucus urged African Nova Scotians to become the first group in Canada to join the SRDC and thus take a seat within the African Union. In this feature, our co-anchor, Melissa Albiani of CKDU, takes us inside the town hall at the former site of Africville in Halifax.
The African diaspora has been invited to be voting members of the AU. To respond to this request, the 6th Region Diaspora Caucus, or SRDC, is traveling across the Western world hosting town halls in order to create chapters and find natural leaders to represent the 6th Region at the AU. On July 30th, the first town hall in Nova Scotia was held at the annual Africville reunion in Halifax, with an all-ages turnout of over 60 people. Dr. Rocky Jones, the president of UJAMA Organization for Economic Recovery in the African Nova Scotia Communities, sees the Nova Scotia SRDC chapter as a way forward.
We must define who we are and what we want. It's not enough to be able to talk about what problems we have. We know the problems we have. We know that our forefathers came through slavery. We know that we've been a source of cheap but readily available labor. We know that we've been shunted to the side in the educational programs. We know that we've been discriminated against and pushed to the back of the line when it comes to getting employment. We know all of the problems. It's the solutions that have been lacking. So now we're looking at the solutions to the problems that exist in the Black community.
Representing the SRDC from Florida was Dr. David Horn, an international educator, strategic planner, and Pan-African activist.
You are not an African because you were born in Africa. You're an African because Africa was born in you. That is a famous quote from Dr. John Henry Clark, one of our great historians.
Dr. Horn addressed tough subjects with humor. He outlined the common denominators that unite the African diaspora. Number one, African descendants face racism. Number two, African descendants have rhythm. Number three, African descendants carry a deep-seated yearning to be invited back to Africa.
You watched us get on the ships and leave, and you never called us back home. Black people have felt abandoned wherever we are. In the Caribbean, in Grenada, whether you're talking about Trinidad, whether you're talking about the United States, we have all felt abandoned. I know you know what I'm talking about, because that's been part of who we are for as long as we have been who we are.
Macaulay, a Toronto SRDC rep, emphasized that it's not only the diaspora who will benefit from joining the AU, but also the diaspora will continue their fight for justice in Africa.
During the colonial regime in Africa and even in the Caribbean, we found out that it was the diasporans, our fathers who came to the West to study, that went back to re-educate our people and fought for our freedom. And this stage, we find out also that to bring Africa to the next level is the diaspora that can do that.
He began his speech by emphasizing the importance of elders in African traditions and recognized that African Nova Scotians are the elders for the diaspora in Canada, and that it's important that they are on board for representing Canada at the AU.
The black people are concerned, or the people of African descent is concerned, and so far as our history in Canada is concerned, Nova Scotia represent the elders of the land.
In order to create an SRDC chapter, the community needs to establish a provincial organizing committee and a community council of elders. Also, they need to prepare for the election of representatives and observers from the province of Nova Scotia. There was a second town hall that took place during the annual Sydney Days of Action on August 3rd, and more town halls are being planned to officially create the Nova Scotia SRDC chapter.
On September 9th, the New York-based group Attica is All of Us commemorated 40 years since the prisoner insurrection at Attica Prison that lasted 4 days in September 1971, shaping modern history. Dee from Prison Radio at CKUT in Montreal caught up with lawyer Joe Heath to honor this important historical event, to tell the story of those eventful 4 days, and to understand why it remains important today. This is a Groundwire special feature, 40 years since Attica.
Between September 9th and September 13th in 1971, a rebellion at Attica Prison in New York State shook Americans and for many transformed how they perceived prisoners and the prison system at that time. The rebellion ended with the slaughter of prisoners and hostages by state troopers, and Americans and the world alike were left horrified. In the aftermath of this event, four lawyers filed a class action suit on behalf of the prisoners. One of those lawyers, who is also with the group Attica is All of Us, Joe Heath, will give us a short history of the rebellion itself, speak about the class action suit, why this day is important to all of us, and what is planned for this monumental 40th anniversary of one of the world's best-known prison insurrections. Hello, Joe Heath, and thank you for being with us today. I was wondering if we could start the interview with you giving us a background on the Attica Rebellion, the era, the conditions of the prisoners lived under at that time, and the rebellion itself.
Well, we have to think back to 1971 and the political climate of the nation at that time. It was a highly political time, coming out of the Vietnam resistance movement and coming out of the civil rights era at the end of the 60s. And you had a very highly politicized population in the prison. There were organizations such as the Young Lords, the Black Panthers. In terms of the conditions in the prisons, they were absolutely horrible and racist to the core. And the proof of that is that there was not one Afro-American guard employed in Attica at that time. And yet the prison population was probably about 70 or more percent non-white. Prisoners had been trying to deal with some of these problems for well over a year. In May of 1971, they submitted a manifesto of problems to the Corrections Department. That was essentially ignored. The day before the rebellion, there had been a fight in one of the yards. Attica is essentially a square divided up into four different prison yards so that each of the blocks go into one yard for their recreation. In A yard, there had been a fight between two prisoners, and the guards did not do anything about it at that time. They then came back on the gallery that night and with excessive force took two people out to the box, the solitary confinement unit. This led to a reaction the next day that when that company and another company were coming back from breakfast, and they thought they would go out into A yard for their normal recreational period, they were locked into the tunnel. And that's when the rebellion actually began. They set upon the guards who were not telling them anything and that were keeping them confined in the tunnel, and came back into the central area of the prison called Times Square. And due to a faulty weld in one of the hinges on one of the gates, were able to gain control of that central area. From there, they got keys, and the entire prison began to rebel. Eventually, and this happened all very somewhat spontaneously from there, but eventually almost 1,300 prisoners ended up in D Yard with about 40 hostages. Over the next 3 days, there was extensive negotiations. It's also important to remember that there was no experience in hostage negotiations, but the prisoners asked for, and a observers committee was set up, and they went back and forth into the yard to try to see if a negotiated solution could be made of this standoff. The observers committee felt and said this to Governor Rockefeller, that if he gave them a little more time, they could find a solution. Unfortunately, Rockefeller, who refused to come to Attica and who sat in his mansion on the Hudson River, Pontico Hills, made statements like, the very fabric of our free society is at stake. And on the morning of September 13th, he ordered an assault force made up of state troopers, guards, local sheriffs, all white, to retake the prison by force. It was an incredibly botched military plan. But they took the prison by force, killing all those people at the beginning. And what we later proved in the civil rights case that came to trial in 1991-1992 was the first trial we had, was that they had made absolutely no planning whatsoever for medical care for the prisoners that were inevitably going to be harmed using the kind of armed force that they did. This is in stark contrast to how quickly the injured hostages were taken out and immediately moved into local hospitals. And 2 days later, the medical examiner of Monroe County in Rochester came out and said that the autopsies proved that all of the hostages had died from gunshot wounds received from the assault force. But after the initial armed assault, they then allowed the guards to go in after the initial armed assault. So we still have excessive force here. We still have very tragic confrontations between the dominant white society and communities of color. We just need to face these realities in order to find a solution. And that's one of the themes that we're going to hope to bring to these commemoration events.
And now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. In August, the National Campus Community Radio Association announced its newest member, CJLO 1690 AM, the community-based campus radio station at Concordia University in Montreal. CJLO has been streaming online since 2003 and hopped onto the AM dial in 2008. It picked up 5 awards at the 2010 CMJ Awards, including CMJ's Station of the Year, and was named by the Huffington Post as one of the 9 best college radio stations. CJLO now joins over 70 stations as a member of the NCRA.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. From CKDU Radio in Halifax, thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Albiani.
And I'm David Parker. Music this week was by JFM and Snail Party. Headlines this week were written by Frieda Worden and Gretchen King. Thanks to our contributors, Dee from Prison Radio, Don Paley, Aaron Lakoff, and Melissa Albiani.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.